Anything combat with Johnny K.
But it's anything combat, though.
Welcome back, combatants, to the Anything Combat Show, wherein we discuss everything mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Johnny K, and today we're joined by Muay Thai fighter. He's had plus 60 fights, former WMC, WBC North American champ, coach of powerhouse Phuket. Please welcome to the show, Paul Banasiak. How are you,
Banasiak.
Paul?
Yeah, you got it. I'm doing well, my brother. I'm doing well. Yeah, we're out here in paradise. It's Saturday. It's the weekend. It's a good time.
What nationality is that surname, Paul?
It's Polish. I was born in Poland, and then I moved to the States when I was 9.
Do you speak Polish?
Yeah, I speak Polish. I can read Polish. The alphabet writing is a little bit tough for me now with English, but yeah, I really enjoy it because recently we've had more Polish people coming by the gym, so I get a little bit more practice. It's been a little while since I've been back to the homeland, but yeah, I still speak it, and my whole family is Polish, and it's all in Poland. Yeah, we're the only immigrants in the U.S., so.
I haven't heard of any Polish Muay Thai fighters that are kind of on the come up right now. Maybe you can help me out with that. But the MMA scene in Poland right now, they're killing it.
Yeah, you know, KSW, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're selling out stadiums. And yeah, Polish people are hard people, you know. They're hard people. So it makes sense, especially for MMA. I have a different type of Polish build. I don't have that construction build, you know, that construction guy. You know, my grandfather actually was on the Polish Olympic team for running, and I think I got some of those genes because I have more of like a swimmer runner's body, but that makes more sense for Muay Thai. That's probably why I joined Muay Thai instead of MMA.
How does that translate over to Muay Thai for you?
It translates well, you know, like I feel like everyone has their talents, and then you have to double down on those talents, and then sometimes, you know, patch up some of the holes. So some of the guys that are more stocky will have usually more of like a heavy punching low kick style. And I think for me, it worked out really well with just the clinch naturally coming to me and some of those things, and just being bony overall. to be able to knee and elbow, that worked out really well for me. And yeah, I think that formed my style like by the end of my career.
Why did you stop your podcast? Are you still doing it?
No, we're both in Thailand at the time, and so it was easy. Sometimes we would physically do it together, and we were able to get on easily, but life happens after, you know. Sean's had a kid, and back in the States now, and yeah, now we are settled here, and I got married, you know, real life stuff, grown up stuff, but we're doing it not in the typical grown up way. We're doing it out here in Thailand.
When did you make your move to Thailand to stay there permanently?
I first moved for a year when I first turned pro. I had my last amateur fight at MSG, and I fought the number one guy in the U.S. at the time, and I won a decision. And then I knew that at the time, one championship wasn't on the Muay Thai scene yet, and it was like the height, kind of like as it was starting to spill over in Lion Fight when they were still on TV, on Axis TV.
Yeah.
So it was kind of starting to dip from that like peak of Lion Fight, and I had one more amateur fight with them, and I won. I sold a fuckload of tickets, so they liked me, and I knew that if I was going to get signed, I was just kind of looking at the landscape of things, and I was like, okay, once you get like 3 wins under your belt, there's not much in the middle, you know. If you beat the guys at the bottom, and there's a ton at the bottom that are just like, okay, I want to turn pro, or maybe they're MMA guys doing Muay Thai for an extra fight, whatever it may be. But there was not that much in the middle. So then your next step is the Cosmo Alexanders and world champions. So I didn't have enough time yet. I didn't have enough experience yet. And that's when I moved to Thailand after that fight. And because I knew I would get signed with them, and I spent a year in Thailand. I lived at Namsaknoi Gym the former head trainer at Chatree's gym at Evolve in Singapore. And I spent 6 months there. I went 4-0, and then I came back to the States, and I had a few fights with them. I had a total of 3 fights with them, and I only moved back for 6 months. So after that year I spent in Thailand, I moved back home for 6 months. I settled in. I bought a car. I bought, got on a phone plan, everything, started to kind of get a home life again. And after 6 months, I said, fuck this shit. I'm done. I'm going back to Thailand. You know, that picture where the guy's just throwing all his papers in the air and he's like, fuck this shit. I'm going to Thailand. That's what I did. And I've been here ever since. So it's been over 6 years now. I came here with my, at the time, friend that became my fiance and now my wife. So, yeah, we're settled in.
How was that like for you going to Thailand, not being a Thai speaking person? There's a lot of foreigners that hang out in Thailand, train and coach there. So how does that all work? Do they speak good English there or something? I don't know how it goes.
Man, if you're in Phuket, you know, I got a lot more practice with my Thai when I was in Chiang Mai, because not many people spoke Thai up there. We lived up north for 2.5 years. But once I got down south, everyone speaks English. And sometimes even when you practice Thai, they'll speak English back to you because they want to learn English. A lot of people in Phuket, the Thais get paid a little extra for being able to speak, you know, with the foreigners. And the economy here is pretty much just based on tourism, so they have to. So it actually helps if they speak English, and they use it as practice with the foreigners. So, yeah, that was the reason I moved down here, because after COVID, Team Quest up north, they kind of dissolved. And that's where, like, Marie Rume, that's in one championship, some UFC guys and some bigger bodies were up there. That's why I was training there. You know, I'm quite tall. And in Thailand, previously, if I trained in I'm 6'4", so 193.5 centimeters, and I fought anywhere from 77 to 90 kilos, most often around, like, the low 80s, though. And so, you know, in Thailand, most of the fights are, like, in that, like, 65 to 70 kilo range for foreigners. And you don't get the right type of training partners when you're sparring with guys that size, because just the style is completely different. And I saw that it wasn't translating in my game. So I was just on the lookout for gyms that had the biggest guys so I can get the real feel of the fights. Cause at the time I was also dabbling in kickboxing when Glory signed me. So I was going between the two sports, making it a little bit tough on myself being in Thailand. I probably should have been in the States for that portion of my career. That probably would have been the smartest thing to do. But in the end, Muay Thai was always my love, and that's what I wanted to do in the end. And, yeah, I just wish I was coming up when, at this time, right now, like, it's like the peak of, being able to showcase your skills with one championship around with the little gloves.
Every single fighter, every Muay Thai fighter that's come on the show, Kevin Ross, when he came on, I was talking to him about how the era of Muay Thai back in like 2010s and stuff and 2009, like that era was so different to the fact that we have one championship Friday night fights now. And I was talking to him about how the scene's just boomed. All the fights are so entertaining now. Everybody loves it. It's growing. It's getting its own type of what can I say? It's got its own legacy compared to like MMA. Mm-hmm. Like it's a product that people watch now and take very seriously when they didn't beforehand for one reason or another. So if you were around now, would you want to go to one championship, or do you think that you could even do it now?
I was signed to fight Chanajon, who ended up fighting, I believe, George Jarvis. So George actually stepped in on that fight because I was supposed to do that fight initially. Without saying too much, like, someone from higher up pulled the fight at the end, because all the people from that were putting the fights together and from the Friday night fights, they were happy to have me, and then just someone from the top kind of pulled the fight, and then I lost a little bit of enthusiasm once that came about, and but I think if I was able to start over, then I would have loved to work my way up to it. I just think now you have to have a hybrid style in a way, because these fights, they're such high pace, they're such high volume. You don't get as much time to do setups and play the game, you know, the type of game that you can play in a 5-round fight. And that's why I enjoy watching the prime cards and the championship fights where they do get 5 rounds. Because even if the fight finishes in the first or second round, you see a little bit more of a tactical approach, and you can kind of study it, you know, and take things away from it. But when it comes to the 3-round fights every Friday, a little like I really enjoyed it the first few weeks, but after a little bit of time, it gets a bit exhausting, even for someone that loves fighting, kind of. A firefight coming out, next firefight. You know, it's kind of the same thing on repeat. I do enjoy the art in it. Maybe I'm getting a little bit older now, so maybe that's part of it. But I like a mix of the two. So I do enjoy when it's the 5-round championship fight, so you can get a little bit more of a feel for the skill levels of the fighters.
How old are you right now?
I'm just 31.
So, how long do you think you'll fight for?
I'm done now, so I retired in December. I got married in the summer here in Thailand, and that was after my WBC North American fight. Then I came back. I fought at Lumpini for the international WMC title to set me up for the world title. And then we just had some fights, like kind of getting pushed around, and I thought I would get one more in before the wedding. It didn't end up happening. So those 2 months were actually the longest I ever took off from fighting. I started when I was 18. I was in a backyard, and my friend used to just bring friends over to have a few scraps, and we'd go kind of round robin with each other, with whoever showed up from, you know, from school or from the block, and we'd just go in his backyard and you know, trade hands. And one of the guys that came was actually trained. He trained a bit of boxing, he trained a bit of Muay Thai, and he just whooped everyone's ass. So like looking back now, I'm kind of like, that's messed up. You know, you were sandbagging us. But it's what got me into fighting, 'cause I beat up a couple guys, and then he whooped my ass. So I went up to him after and I asked him, teach me, you know, show me what this is all about. What is this? So he brought me out to a gym, and it was an affiliate from Sit Yo Tong. So I was kind of lucky back then. You know, 2010, I started when I was 18. So, you know, I didn't start like super late, but I didn't start early either. And at the time, social media wasn't huge when it comes to Muay Thai. So I didn't know if I was learning, you know, Bushido or if I was learning Muay Thai. So I was a little bit lucky that it was connected through an affiliation that was rather good. You know, it was through Mark Delagrati in Boston. One of his students was teaching in Connecticut. And yeah, that's how I got into it.
Did you really want to end fighting, or did you want to continue?
You know, once you're like that 30 number hits, and then you think about everything in life, you know, like I just got married, so you think about family, you think about this, you think about business, you think about just the reality of life. And I've always been super honest with myself. Like when I think I can beat guys, I speak my mind. When I think it's a hard fight, I always prepare. But these last few I wasn't able to stay healthy, and I wasn't able to perform at my potential. So perhaps it was a mix of things, but the main thing was that I knew that if I allowed my ego to keep playing, I would just keep taking fights, even if I was injured. You know, I've had over 60 fights. I've never missed weight. I've never pulled out of a fight. So I knew I would keep taking them no matter what the result was. And maybe it's a kind of a safeguard. now that I think about it, just to make sure that I get myself healthy again. I'm not saying never. It has to be something exciting, but that was the main thing, you know. That fight to go into one championship, it was something different. It was something exciting. You know, when I was first coming up, like I said, in my first year, you know, I signed with Lion Fight, I signed with Glory, and I see these names, you know. Like, I go on the co-main event, and right after me is Lordzilla, right? And then I go on the next card, and I'm the co-main event, and right after me is Joe Nadawa and Pechtanong fighting each other. So, you know, then you see guys like Cosmo and you see guys like Nikki Holskin and you go, okay, maybe I fight these guys one day. And now, unless you're in one, there's not as many names, you know, like you were talking about Kevin, you know, all these guys that were coming up about 10 years ago, they were really trailblazers and they were creating a name for themselves. And I don't know if it's just the saturation of social media or whatever it may be, but not as many exciting fights and opportunities at this point in my life and my career. So if there was something extremely exciting or profitable or something that, you know, got me up to be able to sacrifice the time away from family, from work, from everything else, then maybe I would come back to it. But I love coaching. I love coaching. I love the art. I'm still in the gym every day, you know, coaching, but I'm also training and working out still. So I'm staying in shape and, just getting my body healthy again. Yeah. That was the main thing, is trying to keep my body healthy. I beat it up a lot throughout the years, especially when I was younger, because I felt like I was trying to play catch up. I felt like so many guys were so much more experienced and I was getting opportunities, that I didn't have the experience for yet. And I was getting so goddamn close. I just didn't have the experience yet. And then once I got the experience after COVID, went on a big winning streak, KO, KO, I had 5 knockouts in a row. And then that's where I started saying yes to everything again, and the injury started coming back. So we're just in a phase of, like, getting everything back to baseline.
What I think one championship should do is, I think that they should release the barriers to entry in the actual promotion. I think there should be more, like, smaller promotions that are subsidiary type brands of one championship, so you can get in, kind of similar to how the UFC's done Dana White Contender Series, they've done Road to UFC, The Ultimate Fighter. You know, there's so many different ways that you can win a tournament to get in. I feel like right now with their Friday night fights, I feel like you have to really, you know, travel to Thailand and then get invited. And I feel like there's so many good fighters in Suriname, for example, even in South America. We've seen Reggie Yan Ursel and stuff. There's so much talent there. Like, I would love to see a tournament that they can hold there where you just have like a Suriname tournament where 30 people enter and one guy gets put into one championship. I think that would make the comp better. It would grow the business, and I think that's what they should do for all the nations that aren't around Asia, like your America and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they have the Road to One Championship. There's one going on right now. There's one in the US, and then eventually there's one in Australia, one in the
Is
UK.
Is that televised?
No, so it'll be – so
see
yeah,
what I mean,
be,
though?
Yeah.
See how I'm like, people need to grow their socials, their brand to, like, be known as a fighter. So when they fight for one championship, people know them. Like, in the Dana White Contender Series, if you see a fighter like the Tiger Muay Thai winner, Mike Davis, friend of the show, right? He won Tiger Muay Thai. Everyone knew him from that. Then he went on Dana White Contender Series. I think he lost, and then everyone went, oh, this guy, his name got put out there, and now he's on a ridiculous streak in the UFC. But we needed those, you know, the preliminary type broadcasts with Dana White Contender Series to see these up and comers, because that's what the sport is. Because when you get the up and comers coming out, and then they go on their massive streak, then they're the champion, and you're like, okay, they're well known. But before that is important.
Yeah, I think some of the promotions are perhaps looking at short-term gains rather than long-term gains, and especially in terms of the fighters, because some of them will be behind a paywall, so the only people really watching are your direct supporters, not the general public. So not as many eyes get on it. And then afterwards, many of them don't even release the fights on YouTube or anywhere else to watch. And by that time, everyone already knows the results and they're less likely to watch them. So that's a good point, is to just be able to live stream it, to put it on YouTube. So whatever amount of money that you're getting from just those direct viewers that are your followers, maybe that's what's keeping I don't know the books on these smaller promotions, these local promotions, but if ONE Championship can step in and perhaps offer them exposure through their channels as some type of ONE Championship subsidiary, that's like a road to one, but it's a channel for it that they're able to broadcast these fights. Like, these are the up and coming fighters, tell their stories. I think that would help immensely in growing the fighters that are coming up, especially from the West and different parts outside of Asia.
Seeing that you were in the West and stuff, and you were fighting there, how hard was it to beat a Thai inside Thailand?
I'm a bigger guy, so I've only had a few fights, like Kontalai, who's fighting on RWS tonight. I KO'd him earlier last year, or no, 2 years ago. No, that was my first fight back from COVID. And he's a bigger guy, like bigger in terms of weight, but he's not bigger. So I fought quite a few guys, like a Northern Thailand champion. There was another Thai that was on RWS just now that fought Dave LeDuc as well. His opponent, Mohammed from Iran, that won. I KO'd him at Lumpini for the WMC belt. So a lot of guys that I have had in common. I think you have to learn to play the game as a foreigner, but you also have to bring some type of different dynamicism to your striking. And I think that's where you see the success of foreigners, because playing the game with them is extremely, extremely difficult. You know, I fought a lot of foreigners where they're bigger than me. I had a fight in Samui against a Czech fighter who was like 220 pounds. And at the time, I might have been like 185 soaking wet. And trainer Gay was in my corner. My last fight was against a Thai, and he was smaller than me. So I complained to trainer Gay. I go, like, come on, man. Like, I don't want to be fighting these guys. And I think he kind of took it like, oh, okay, you don't want to fight these guys? Okay, 2 weeks from now, you have one more fight. I go, okay, sounds good. And then we show up to the arena, and I go, oh, okay, I know who I'm fighting. This fucking giant right here. And yeah,
How
he put
big
me
was
in the
this
fight.
unit?
Sorry?
How big was your opponent?
Yeah, he was like maybe an inch or two shorter than me, but he looked like the twin brother Arthur Kashenko, like his younger brother. He looked like a younger brother of Arthur Kashenko, Czech guy. And yeah, he had heavy strikes, more of a K1 style. It's crazy how some of these foreigners come in here and then they kind of like set rules, even though you're in Thailand and set to fight Muay Thai. So they took elbows out of the equation, and I just left kicked him from the outside, just left kick, left kick. And I played the game, right? But when I try to play the game against the Thais, like when I fought in Chiang Mai or in Bangkok, the difference in what your legs feel like after your shins is like the way they check, the way they play the game, the way they block. Man, it is painful. It is you got to be able to have a lot of resilience and good conditioning to be able to play that game. And that's why you see the Thais training so hard out here, doing 5 rounds, 20 kicks end of each round, 200 kicks at the end of training, 300 knees, 400 knees, teeps, because the repetition when you play the game of Muay Thai, right, that type of femur game, it takes a ton of conditioning. So it's conditioning for your mind and it's conditioning for your body, because you have to stay alert the entire time when you're playing the game, where you're not like a clinch style fighter. You can kind of settle in. You always have to be using your eyes. You always have to be using your feet, and you have to be able to kick and kick back and play the game and go back and forth until you finish the exchange and you end up on top of the exchange. And then they have to come to you. So now you have to play defense and control the points. And yeah, those fights, you know, my shins would be banged up for weeks versus fighting the foreigner. I might have kicked him 100 times in that fight, and it was all gravy after. Yeah, body felt good.
Paul, can you explain to me what it takes to have a dynamic style in Muay Thai, as you were saying before?
Yeah, I think the foreigners are now chaining together kind of what you see. They're building a great fundamental game of Muay Thai. So you see great technique of being able to exchange kicks, being able to block good balance, and then chaining the fakes from the fundamental techniques into longer chain combination, more volume. And not just sticking to the game of points, but doing damage mixed with the points and the volume. So I think it's a little bit of a harder game, but you see a lot of the guys now, even foreigners, having a lot more fights. There's a RWS fight tonight, I believe, with Victor Hugo and Joe Ryan from the UK. And you can see both of them have nearly 100 fights each, and Joe Ryan's only, he's a teenager still. So you see this more and more and more often. So these guys have a lot of time to develop in these local tournaments. They have a lot more time to play the game and kind of develop the fundamentals that the Thais have. But I think they're able to also zone in a little bit more because they're able to communicate with their coaches and formulate more of a game plan. When before, I think a lot of guys that were coming into camps, it was like, you kind of have to learn as you go, feel it out. You get thrown into the clinch. You don't get as much direction. You have to feel it out yourself. So I think a lot of them are getting accelerated training because they're getting the volume that the Thais are getting, but they're also getting a lot more coaching and direct, more of a direct and programmed approach of the Western world. So mixing kind of the traditional aspect with the like Western scientific aspect as well, and the athleticism that they can bring as well from sports science.
When you were fighting in Glory, were you ever on a card with Pereira?
Yes, I believe my Chicago or LA, either Chicago or LA. I believe he fought Jason Wilness. I think that was the fight where he fought Jason Wilness. Yeah. I was on the
Is that the
undercard. My
one
first,
where he hit him with the flying knee?
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah, they fought a few times. I can't remember which one exactly it was, but it was the one he hit him with the flying knee. There was another card I was on with Thiago Silva, from the UFC. I fought Ivan Galaz my first fight. That's how I got, and I fought him at Madison Square Garden on 6 days' notice because I was going back and forth with Lion Fight. We were having kind of a dispute over signing contracts. I saw a lot of the guys weren't getting fights even though they were signing contracts, and then they slid in on short notice because Ivan Galaz, a guy who fought Pereira, he was ranked top five in Glory at the time at middleweight. He went down and they asked me to fight on 6 days' notice. I go, okay, cool. I trained for 2 days and we fought. It was a pretty great fight. Yeah.
Did you ever fight Eddie Forkilo?
So that was the only 85 kilo. It was 85 kilos, and that was the only fight. Because it was short notice, so I went up in the weight, and it was an opportunity.
That's kind of
And
weird around the weight. I've never even heard of someone fighting at 85. It's always 83.9, 84. So what's that in pounds? Like 188?
87,
That's
yeah. Go
weird,
go
bro.
if go if you if you go into their weight classes, their middle weight is 85 kilos, and then it's 77, and then it goes up to 85, which is 187. Yeah,
That's
it's a
so
bit of an
weird.
awkward weight. Yeah.
With the powerhouse, Phuket, when did you start there? When did they invite you to become a coach?
Recently, I've become a coach because I was a fighter here for nearly 3 years. I came at the end of COVID. That's what I was saying. Team Quest up north dissipated, and I was looking for a new home. And at the end of COVID, I noticed there was a lot of big boys here at the time. I think Khalil Roundtree was training here, and it was the original team with the current owner, Jack,
Have you worked with
and.
him?
Yeah. We did some clinching, some sparrings. There's two guys I've sparred where if I cover, I get a full block. I can see the shot coming. I block it. And I go, okay, I don't want to feel that again. I need to just fully get myself out of the way. It's him and Malikan. It was those two guys that I've sparred with. Is Khalil and Malikan are the two guys that, yeah, you can block the shot, but you're feeling it even through the guard. You're feeling it through the glove. Those guys have some serious power behind their shots.
Paul, have you been impressed with how MMA fighters have increased their Thai game, similar to Khalil?
Sure. You know, the first aspect, and this isn't someone that's known for Muay Thai, it was just, it dumbfounded me for a long time that guys aren't mixing in elbows very well in MMA, especially in clinch situations. And Kamaru was the first one that impressed me. I was like, there it is, finally. You know, a guy that's able to switch from the legs to elbows, and then when you bring your hands back up to defend yourself, then he puts your ass on the ground and then does his thing. And
that's so interesting. That's so interesting because Kamaru, he doesn't really do that often in his fights.
His first time, I believe it was against Woodley. I just remember watching one of his first fights on the come up where it really impressed me. It was the fact that he was switching up between going for the takedown and then in the clinch actually striking and hitting the elbows. And
yeah, he did. He did clinch strike Woodley in that fight a lot. That was very impressive. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and that's what first impressed me, and I was thinking to myself, why doesn't this happen more often? And John Jones was always known for being able to land those elbows, I think, especially with his length and setting
Do you know who else is a really good example of that in MMA?
You tell me.
It's Matt Brown. I think he's coming on the show soon because – but Matt Brown, he was always in the grappling exchanges, always throwing a quick little knee, or always in a clinch scenario when he goes for the grappling, he'll throw a cheeky elbow. And it's always about it's always about finding where they're really uncomfortable. I always use the example of when he was in side control, passing from side control to top mount, he would throw the knee in the top mount, meaning that he would be in side control, throw the knee on their stomach and go into top mount, which is basically meshing the striking into the grappling, that fight with, he did that too, with, which was Eric Silva. I think that fight took place in like 2012, 2013. So since then, if you were to ask me how many fighters do that, it's been 11 years and I don't really fucking have that many fighters that I can choose from. So that just goes to show you that it's even underutilized now.
Yeah, I love it. And then you have the infamous Diego Sanchez elbow. You know, he pulled him from the teep and just pulled the leg in right into the elbow. That was beautiful, beautiful work. Yeah, I love those transitions. And that's what dynamic striking is chaining the different ranges and being able to adapt on the fly, whether you're in the long range where you're in kicking range, and then being able to fake your shots from that range into the short range. And that's where you see real mastery and dynamic striking, is being able to set type of patterns, set foundational work, and then break them into trickery, into being able to land the knees and the elbows in the short range, and then be able to get back to your other game. Like a lot of the guys that I work with here, everyone I try to develop on the things that I kind of found out later in my game and was able to adapt. I wish I would have been able to start with it, which is just creating low risk prods and gaining information and just starting to train the eyes from the beginning. So that way you can, a lot of guys want to have fancy footwork, hit angles right away. But if you're hitting angles without any type of trap or setup to get your guy to stand still, then he can just follow you and cut you off, or use the angle to his advantage where you're angling off and then he catches you over the top. So if you're able to set them up from the center and then you hit the fake, or you're able to hit the angle while they're standing still, while they're blocking, while they're flinching, while you're getting them to freeze, then all that fancy stuff doesn't look as fancy because you can just cut the angles real tight. It doesn't need a lot of movement. All it needs is efficient setups, efficient prods, efficient fakes, so that way you can get them to where you want them to be.
You were talking about the pace of the ONE Championship Friday night fight, and basically, from what I've seen, they've been really quick. The pace is fast as. So my question for you is, how do you slow the fight down so people don't abuse that pace on you in your fights?
I think you got to be able to frame well. You have to use the teep well. Super Like is actually really good at doing it. So if you want to study someone, he's quite good at being able to mix up the pace. And he does exactly what I just spoke of being able to frees you up. So you don't just get a free entry every single time. First time he'll teep you. Second time, maybe he'll teep you. Maybe he'll just raise the leg and go straight into the jab. Maybe he'll pick your leg. Maybe he'll raise the leg, fake the jab, and low kick, So every time that you're entering, you have something to think about. And it's not just one option. They all can look the same. Like the jab can feed the teep. The teep can feed the jab. And that can feed the power side. So now you're worried about three different things when you're entering. And when that happens, you can slow down the pace of the fight and make them dance to your dance. And I think he does that super, super well.
What keeps you going, seeing that you've kind of retired a little bit and now you're doing your training people as a coach. So what do you think keeps you going?
There's no end to this. There's always different aspects of the game that I'm learning about. There's always evolution that's happening in the game, so you have to adapt. And the main thing is being able to pass that on to other people and take the lessons that I had to learn the hard way for them to be able to cruise through and maybe get to a higher level before they take the same amount of damage. I want people to feel confident to go through the process and not feel alone. I had to kind of make my own way. I came from Connecticut, not really known for creating superstars or well-known fighters. We've had a few guys like Nick Newell that came up in the UFC. One of my former students that then came up in New England was William Knight for a bit. And then, now you have Pereira and the people there, but at the time, I had to go to New York. I had to go to Florida. I had to travel. I would have to fly to California to do a month camp and just all over the world until I started settling into Thailand. If I can bring everything that I've learned at all these different camps and all these different places and kind of mesh it all together to give you the answers that you seek. I know what it's like to train with the best, and I know what it's like to have to rely upon yourself. I know what it's like to, work with promoters that are forcing you into fights, or if you're the favorite, or now they're using you to build someone else up. I didn't have anyone by my side that was able to give me that experience that they went through. So hopefully I can do that for those that are coming up now, and they can learn from it a little bit earlier on before they have to learn it the hard way.
Paul, you wrote something a little bit interesting. You said that life has its way of pulling us in multiple directions. So, how do you think that somebody finds what's truly important to them? How did you do it?
I just try to stay authentic to myself, and I did a lot of things that if I look back on right now, they don't make too much sense. But
What was one of them?
I went to college. I was an immigrant kid. My parents wanted me to go through college and have a 9 to 5 job because they gave me the opportunity to have that. I didn't have to grow up in a little village town in Poland and work, just some whatever job. They gave me the opportunity to come to the US and have the American dream. And And I kind of, the day after I graduated college is the day that I moved out to Thailand. You know, I dropped everything. Like I told you, I bought a car again. I settled into life and I felt like I needed something more. Maybe perhaps it was the fear of every day being the same over and over and over again. I wanted something completely different. You know, I watched my mother take her whole entire life that she worked for. She had a master's degree. She was the first one in the family to be able to accomplish that and to venture outside the country. And seeing her do that, being able to kind of leave everything behind and start over, go to America, start cleaning houses and building her own way up. I think I wanted that sense of freedom myself. And I just wanted to feel the extremes that life has to offer. You know, I never liked team sports. I wanted to feel the extreme of what it's like for everything to be on me, all the pressure to be on me. So that way, if I fail, there's nobody to blame but myself. If I succeed, then I can feel proud of the work that I've done. And yeah, I think that's what has always driven me through the years is just following that passion, and then just creating a life that suits that. In a way where it makes it possible, you know, like there was times where I lived on $400 a month, $500 a month when I was up north, and you know, when I was back home before, I was making nearly 2 grand a week. So the difference in my income was completely different, but the fulfillment that I got from following my own path and building it and just kind of working for myself is something that I don't think can be replaced. And you know, there's only so much time to do something that's physical and to take risks before real life sets in. So I think you got to do it, especially when you don't have those commitments yet and you're still younger. I think you should just be able to go all in. You got to go all in because those years are going to pass by no matter what. So you might as well take that risk earlier on.
Final question for today. You wrote about cleansing your ego after every single fight and in the preparation of each fight. I find that when I'm not good at something, I pretend to just like it doesn't exist. I just pretend that it's not there so I don't have to face it and have to build it. And you said that you relentlessly attack your imperfections and your ego fights against this. This is what I'm trying to do. So, what did that mean for you?
I'm my own biggest critic, and with every fight, I would have to watch it back and kind of go back to seeing, you know, what else I can perfect. And that's a journey that you go on through forever, but I think it's a habit that you also build over time, like anything else, and it becomes easier to do. You know, if you're able to look at things objectively, then I think you're able to make progress. There are so many people that are in the gym and they say like, oh, you know, like, don't show me that video. I don't want to see myself, you know? Why? But because then I see, you know, what I really look like. I think my hands are up, but they're not really up. You know, I think I look better than I actually am. I go, well, wouldn't you rather see that today? So then tomorrow, maybe you can be a little bit better, you know? Rather than a year passing by, you know, at some point you're gonna realize it either the hard way or you do it to yourself, put yourself through it. You know, it's the different. If you have the attitude of, okay, I'm willing to step into the fire, you should be able to do it in the fight. You should be able to do it in training. And that doesn't mean, oh, stepping in the fire and trading shots with someone. That means stepping into the fire and facing reality. You know, like, where am I? Where am I in life? Am I mentally resilient enough for this? And if I'm not, what can I do to make myself more mentally resilient? You know, am I disciplined? Am I showing up to every single class? And you just have to face it. There are so many guys here that, you know, it takes a real bad knockout a lot of times, and they go, okay, I had to face the music. I had to change this. I had to change that because reality never set in until that happened. And I think I've just seen it too many times where I just wanted to avoid that at all costs. So I try to learn from the lessons of others and listen to others. You know, other people that are older and they have experience, they have this wisdom and they repeat the same things over and over again for a reason. I think it's wise to listen to them.
That's all we have time for, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Paul, for coming on the show. Is there any final remarks you want to say to the fans at home as we wrap up the podcast today?
No, cheers. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, if you guys want some great training here in Thailand, in Paradise, we have a small yet big field gym. You know, we have high level fighters everywhere from the local scene to one championship to international and world titles. And I think we have something unique here because we do exactly what we talked about earlier, the blend of dynamic training, the Thai rhythm, you know, of 2 hours in every session and putting in the volume, but also with intent. So all of our programming is intention based. All of our drilling is kind of in a Western style, but we still do the entire Thai routine. So we're trying to combine the two and stay up to date with the times.
Follow Paul on Instagram, link in the description, and follow Anything Combat. We will see you guys next time. Bye-bye.